And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. I am Alan Park, and these are Conspiracy Queries. Today we have with us longtime researcher of many conspiracies, Ulla Domagard, all the way from Sweden, and Skype. Thanks, Skype. Skype pretty much held together for the entire interview. We did have a little bit of trouble at the front end. And Ulla has said this happens to him many times. He has drawn up the incredibly complex spider web that is the nucleus of the Brotherhood and brotherhoods that do overlap that he says definitely control political assassinations and shape the flow of the world. Ulla Domagard from Sweden is my guest. So stick around for that. It's a good one. Very fascinating. And let's turn more to some local things at the moment. Before I get into my discussion with Ulla, you've heard him all over the place. Did I just leave him and I'm going to talk about him some more? I guess I am. He is dedicated, as he says, to revealing the New World Order agenda. And that specifically includes and what he primarily researches are the false flag operations that go on all over the world. And he would like to point out that he is not to spread fear. He does not want to do that by exposing the truth. He just wants to get it out there because he feels that's the best thing that can happen. So Ulla will be joining us shortly. In the meantime, as I said before, I was interrupted by my own self. It turns out that the CETA agreement Well, it's in a position right now where it might not go through. This is the secret trade deal that our hilariously ridiculous Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who began his nonsensical run as tyrant of this country, told us everything would be accountable and visible. You know, and then he goes about dealing with these different secret trade deals that apparently we're not allowed to read as Canadian citizens until once the deal is passed. Who else does something so stupid as that? Do you do that? Do you buy things that you don't even really know what they are and don't really bother to check and see what they're all about and how they work and if they best suit you? You know, maybe you have a choice for a different cable provider or another selection for dinner tonight rather than letting some pretty much jackbooted clown with a Lego man haircut tell you what you can do after the fact that he's already whipped this together. Fortunately, the Germans and some of the Europeans are not as interested in keeping this deal together as some of the cabal, both industrial and political, that are putting this thing down our throats. Because those deals never really work out too well, and you can't trust the ones that are brewed up in secret, stupid. So stop it, Stephen. Cannot wait till they flush this guy down the toilet bowl of history, where he'll be processed and spat out into the local water processing plant. With any luck, with any luck. And he had another series of events that were kind of funny as well. He chose to put a new harsh law on prostitution together. And boy, the penalties are so damning. And then said, well, most Canadians are with this. They're fine with this kind of thing, and we're going to go ahead and make ourselves a more moral and just society, as though interfering in someone else's business is ever moral or just. So that's how you can tell it's on its ear right there. But then a secret internal poll by the Justice Department of this country determined that most Canadians are against this ruling, which completely contradicts what this fella had to say to us. There was another poll done, another poll kept secret as well about the marijuana and the new MMPR. It's some kind of a medical processing board to whether you're lucky enough or able or deserved to access a plant that grows out of the ground. And he said the most Canadians were okay with what he had to say about that too, which was basically punitive and putting it, you know, into the trash bin of history the best he could. And most people, apparently, in another poll that they decided not to release because it directly contradicts what he has to say again, is not going through. Well, the poll says it will go through. It has gone through. But the poll says most people are not interested in this and that decriminalization should be the way. So this is the rantings and ramblings of myself. But I am reflecting on the rantings and ramblings of the prime minister of this country, who claims to be holding a majority office. And the more I look at it, and the more I see the idiocy and criminality, let's not leave that out. It's not all stupid. But he absolutely does have a majority. And that is, most people in this country do not like him and did not vote for him and will not do so again. So, with that out of the way, and a little Canadian news for you, let's go to our interview. Welcome, Ola, from Sweden. Thank you very much. Boy, it's great to have you here on Conspiracy Queries. And you've got a huge book, a fantastically well-researched and interesting book to read. I've not read all of it myself. I'd love to do so over the next couple of weeks. But wow, I had to get to this call to you first. Folks, listen, you got to read this thing called Coup d'etat in slow motion. This is a breakdown of the JFK assassination and the first staggering fact about it. Please tell us how long you researched this book, something like 30 years?
Yes, 30 years. It is a little bit more. But actually, it's mainly focused around this assassination of the Swedish prime minister, but with all the connections to other major assassinations, including the JFK assassination. Because it turns out that people that were in Dealey Plaza in 1963 were actually on location in Stockholm 23 years later, taking out the Swedish prime minister. And these people have also been involved in so many other assassinations, if my research is correct.
And your research being something that you've spent a lot of time on, this isn't just a couple of weeks worth of digging and you put it together. So when you say the same people, 23 years later, which is often a symbolically important number, we might get to that later, exactly who are these people that were involved in the JFK hit and then were 23 years later involved in the assassination of your political leader?
I tell you, in the late 50s, early 1960s, under this was the time when Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the States, and his vice president, Richard Nixon, was given the task to create a super secret team of assassins, top class assassins, to be used to eliminate political leaders internationally, globally, or whoever they had problems with. So the task was, he was supervising it, Nixon was supervising it, and he gave the task to people in the CIA, people like Ted Shackley, also called the Blonde Ghost, David Attlee Phillips, who was actually the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy of the JFK assassination, but also the controller of many, many other key people in major assassinations, one of them being James Files, who is the shooter behind the picket fence. But I can go into great details about the JFK assassination because this is it's so complex and so big and with multiple shooters. But he was also the controller of Michael Vernon Townley, a serial killer. And
oh, we lost him for a second. Come on back. Are we still there?
these things, boom, it's on more or less 90% of all shows.
I was going to say, I don't know if people caught that, but we were cut off very shortly after you named some names, which I didn't even have time to write down, so somebody else seems like they might have. And then the Skype went dead, and I've been trying to call you back. Anyway.
I can just say it keeps happening, so I don't know. It's up to you to make up your own mind. It's easy to get paranoid, but it's like every single time these names comes up, boom, technical things happen. That's why I always give a landline as a backup number.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't have that. Unbelievable. Well, let's give those names again. No, I'm just kidding. We'll get to those later. Let's try to get a little more discussion underway before we summon the ghosts.
No, it's up to you.
Yeah, okay.
The whole thing is that in the late 50s, early 1960s, an order was given, or the idea came up, to create a super team of elite assassins. These were recruited from Cuba, mostly as exiled Cubans in Miami. And the whole task was given to Richard Nixon to form this team of assassins. He gave the order to do this to people like Ted Shackley, the blonde ghost from CIA, E. Howard Hunt, who is he's quite well known from the Watergate burglary and many, many, many other conspiracies globally. So is the one I just mentioned, Ted Shackley, who is later the chief of the Western Hemisphere for covert operations, so not an amateur in any way.
And just before we continue, do you know any current names filling those very positions? Because you're talking about when this whole assassination team was drummed up. Do we have any current day leads, or is it something that doesn't exist anymore to your knowledge?
No, but they keep changing form and shapes and names. More nowadays, it's gone so high tech, everything, and there's so many different offsprings out of it. This is called the grandmother of operations. You know, the basic, that was when they created the template, more or less, that has been used since then. But some of the core members of this group, it was a group called Operation 40, and the core members of this group have been working. They've been very, very active for decades, and some of them are still alive and quite active as well. So it's incredible what is going on around this group. That is why I focus so much time and effort trying to expose the members, because these members are the ones that connect so many dots in these conspiracies globally, where it looks like we're looking at very separate events. But once you start seeing who carries them out, where the orders come from, it will lead you back to the same group again and again and again and again.
And Richard Nixon was at the helm of this, the later president.
It was Richard Nixon that was given the task to organize this group. Then the paymaster of it was somebody else, I'm sure you know. His name is George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. He was the paymaster. He was quite young at the time. But he was the son of Prescott Bush, who was more or less he had more or less the same task, but for Adolf Hitler. He was the one funneling funds from the military-industrial complex and the global elite into Adolf Hitler and other parts of in the Second World War. So we're looking at the same people just moving into another strategy after the Second World War.
So it's safe to say then, if George Bush Senior, his father Prescott, as you're saying, was dealing the paymaster, was a paymaster, and he actually was charged. And I believe three times for trading with the enemy.
Yeah, and that's true.
Is it reasonable to say then that the Bush family legacy, which wasn't really around before Prescott Bush, is it fair to say that the entire Bush legacy on down to today has been and was funded by and generated by Nazi profiteering?
Yeah, I think the more you look into the whole Bush family down the line, we're talking super, super, super criminals, in my opinion. absolute incredible, the level of criminality and the cases they're involved in, the different operations and so on. Especially, I'm not talking about the latest president, George Bush. He's more like a front face, but senior major player in this whole game.
Yeah, he's more like a backdoor, I think, the current incarnation of...
I call him Boy George. He's just there so that the show can continue.
Sure.
You know, and with a front face.
Have you heard about this? Jeb Bush used to be the, the governor, was the governor of Florida, whatever he's doing right now. But it seems like they might be teeing him up because the merry band of Republicans seem to be a pretty sorry bunch of people the last time around if Mitt Romney's going to be your best guy. But I find when they put somebody in there that's already got a name, half of these voters go in the booth and they'll look at their voting slip and go, "Oh, Bush, I heard of that name before." Punch, and he gets to win again.
I would recommend people to start studying history too, because their vote counts, even though most of the elections are rigged. But I tell you, the Bush family would not be on my list. That is for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. This group was, like I said, there was Ted Shackley, David Attlee Phillips was another veteran from the CIA. David Attlee Phillips, we're back to the Operation 40, the team of assassins now.
Okay.
David Attlee Phillips was later also the chief of covert operation for the Western Hemisphere, Black Ops. A major, major player in so many things over the last many decades. And he was actually the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the station chief in Mexico City, the one painting Oswald Black, preparing him as a patsy, without Oswald knowing it, of course. And this David Attlee Phillips, he was also the controller of James Files, who is the one who claims to be the shooter behind the picket fence in Dealey Plaza. Somebody I've studied for years and years, and I totally believe that he was the one doing it.
James, what's his last name?
James Files. He's still around. He's in prison. Files, that's F-I-L-E-S, James Files.
He's still in prison, so he's a very old man by this point.
No, not that old. He was very young. He was only, I think, 21 in 63 when the shots were fired.
Okay.
But he was just many of multiple shooters in Dealey Plaza. But where David Attlee Phillips was one of the main conspirators in the whole setup. It's very, very complex what happened in Dealey Plaza and so on.
Okay,
but if I go back...
Yeah, give us a bit of a breakdown on that, particularly in how it will, as you've learned later, relate to the Swedish assassination of Olaf Palme.
Can I go back to the group of Operation 41st just
Absolutely.
To outline, give a more basic outline?
Absolutely.
Of this group? Because what they did was that George Bush was the paymaster, and he had a man appointed to him. His name was Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez was a major player in Operation 40. He was later one of the main people in the whole Iran-Contra, working closely to Oliver North. And you will see in this interview, we will go back to also in the Iran-Contra, the whole operation, many of the players there were players from or members from Operation 40, one of them being Barry Seals, who was one of the major pilots in the whole Iran-Contra, where weapons were taken from the National Guard, stolen there. Then by the help of the CIA, they replaced the parts where the serial numbers were, so they got blank parts with no numbers. Then were then flown out with military planes, medevac planes and so on, from the States down to countries like Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador and so on, where they were arming the Contras army, a creation totally done by the CIA with major people like Henry Kissinger and so involved in that. And then weapons were going that way, and then the planes were filled up with cocaine, raw cocaine, going back into the States.
And okay. One of the places, let me just say that the raw cocaine going back into the States it was also something that they had profited from.
Massively.
Right. And massively. So just before we continue with that, we have to step aside for a second and listen to some lovely words from some different thoughts from different people. We'll be right back. We were just talking about how one can profit and fund illegal black operations with drug money, specifically cocaine. Ola, pick it up from there, please.
Yeah, no, one of the places, I'm sorry if I go all over the place, but I'm going to tie the whole thing together.
Oh, do so. Feel free to do this. Don't worry. We're all listening. That's what this is for.
Okay. No, when we go to the Iran-Contras, like one of the major or some of the major people in the Iran, in the whole Iran-Contra scandal, are members from Operation 40. I'm going to show how these members are connected to so many different terror acts, assassinations, and other operations. And one of the people that were flying these big military planes with weapons down to Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and so on, and flew drugs back in. They were not, these pilots were often not aware of that drugs were coming back in. They came in big coolers, and one of the pilots were Barry Seals, and another one was Chip Tatum. Chip Tatum is still around, a personal friend of mine and so on, who has, one of the things that he did while flying was that he knew that he was in with the big sharks. So he started collecting a lot of evidence to protect himself. And one of the places they flew these big army planes and landed them were on a small airstrip in Arkansas, just outside a small town called Mena. At that time, the governor of that state was a very unknown person by the name of Bill Clinton. Now, Bill Clinton and his companion, Dan Lasseter, were some of the people who personally were there receiving the drugs. They were there on location receiving the drugs, and sometimes even George Bush Sr. These people were filmed by Chip Tatum, and this is now being used for making a major motion picture and so on. Chip Tatum is, I think, a very believable person. You can find out a lot about him on chiptatum.com.
Chip Tatum has been on the show, and he's going to be back on the show. So that's, yeah.
Excellent. Then also you know that he was a black op assassin. He was a deep cover CIA agent for 25 years. He was not one of the Night Stalker pilots, you know, these black helicopters flying stealth. Mm-hmm. He was also the commander of Pegasus, which is an ultra-secret hit team, personally under the command of George Bush Sr. So he has been very much involved with George Bush Sr. and taking part. I think he carried out about 17 assassinations or operations globally, taking out people. So, I mean, not an amateur. These are heavy players, you know.
Absolutely.
Anyway, if we go back to Operation 40, in that group, there were other people like Frank Sturgis, also called Frank Fiorini. He was...
Frank, what was it? Sturgis or Fiorina?
Fiorini.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of these people came... They escaped from Cuba when Fidel Castro invaded or took over the island. And they escaped to Miami, and that is where they were recruited by David Attlee Phillips and Ted Shackley and so on.
Oh.
They were then trained in Louisiana, in Miami, and also down in Guatemala. They were trained in everything from jungle warfare to explosives, poisons, you name it, whatever that could be used to take someone out. And the main operation they were involved in was to try and take out Fidel Castro, to get him dead, you know, get him off the island of Cuba, because when Castro took over there, that hit very badly on the global elite, because of there was so much, you know, the whole casino thing and all that was going around with drugs and so on, where Cuba was used. When Fidel Castro took over, that stopped overnight. It was just shut down. So there was a lot of very, very upset people.
Well, it's always intrigued me how, Castro has always been this flashpoint, whether Kennedy was being told that he had to go in there and invade him, and a lot of people upset with Fidel Castro, yet he managed to survive. He's still alive? I mean, how did he not get taken out?
Good question. They tried many times, I tell you, but I can't answer it. I just know that they tried a lot and they never succeeded. And then I think over the years he became less and less of a threat, so they let him be, you know. I mean, the whole island was shut down anyway, so they had control over it that way.
Right. Okay.
But then what happened after, I think it was after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when there was a ship coming with missiles from Russia going towards Cuba, and it was discovered, and Kennedy and the whole military staff warned Khrushchev and said, if this ship passes, if it crosses this longitude, and they gave a specific sort of like borderline, if this ship crosses this, we will open fire on you. And they were talking about nuclear war. And by mistake, this ship actually crossed this line. So the whole military industrial complex and so on were cheering on Kennedy, just get going, you know, press the button. And he was sitting there. There were witnesses that have explained this later. They said he was sitting there with tears in his eyes and just saying, I refuse to be the one that does this to the world. And in my opinion, up until then, he had been a president, you know, lots of glamour, lots of this whole up thing and quite easily to manipulate with. But after that, it was like he had like an enlightened experience, almost like he said, my God, we almost blew the whole world into pieces. So from now on, we need to stop this madness. We need to stop it, and we need to do it now.
And unfortunately, that message carried that he instead would be blown to pieces.
There you go. But that was the point, I think, where he suddenly changed direction and became a major threat to the military industrial complex, the mafia, the CIA, the Federal Bank Reserve, I mean, all of these, the Federal Reserve Bank, all of these institutions that had helped him to power some of them. And now suddenly he turned his back against them and attacked them instead. So this was when I believe he signed his own death warrant, you know, also when he decided to withdraw out of Vietnam. Because Vietnam was most people are not aware of this. At that time, Vietnam was not an American war almost. It was a French war that the U.S. had taken over, but they only had a few thousand advisors down there. But due to the closeness to the Golden Triangle and the whole drug trade, the old Indochina and that whole part, that was the thing that they needed going. They were trying everything they could to get it to become an American war and get the whole transport system set up, where Kennedy said, I'm going to withdraw, and before 1965, we're going to be out there, all of us. So that was just another one. And he fired three of the holy cows in the CIA, one of them being Alan Dulles.
Right. Who then later was very instrumental in the investigation, apparently.
And the assassination.
And the assassination, yeah. But it was funny that officially he was, we have to find out what happened here.
Exactly. Now, this Alan Dulles is really interesting because he and his brother, John Foster, they were lawyers before, and they were lawyers working for Adolf Hitler.
The Dulles brothers were lawyers working for Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. And then when the Second World War ended, the whole Operation Paperclip was organized. Operation Paperclip was when they dumped a few patsies for the trial in Nuremberg. There were like 12 low-key generals and some like Hermann Göring and so on. They had to take the fall for the whole Nazi war machine. But we're talking thousands and thousands of hardened SS veterans and Nazi veterans were exported in a rat line going with the help of the Vatican State. They were pumped out, and these SS veterans and Nazis were exported into the States, into South America and so on, where they started infiltrating the whole system, and where they were also very, very important in the whole building of what was called OSS, which later turned into the CIA.
Right.
As well as NASA, you know, the whole rocket science with Wannes von Braun and...
Oh, JPL. And yeah.
JPL, you have the whole banking system. You got, they totally infiltrated the whole thing. And this was without people knowing. Normal people had no idea. They thought the Second World War ended. Thank God we got rid of that Nazi threat. I'm sorry, you just imported them instead.
They buried it. They hid it, and they made it all the more powerful for being a secret entity instead of something everybody could see and make decisions about.
Spot on. And another guy they used was a very high up general, SS general called Reinhard Gehlen. He was part of building up the whole Gladio network in all the NATO countries in Europe and in state, where the Gladio is like a super secret ghost army that most people are not even aware of exist. So he was also very instrumental in many other things, this Reinhard Gehlen. And one of the other things he did was as well was killing Nikola Tesla, which this is a this Tesla is, I mean, nowadays he's becoming more and more famous for his incredible inventions.
And we should have gone that way. We obviously clearly should have gone that way rather than the other way. And when I say that, I mean, you know, means of propulsion, electricity, energy consumption, all of that. We've got the wrong masters at the helm and the paymasters in their wake. It's so bad that Tesla was taken out the way he was.
Incredible. And it was Reinhard Gehlen and Otto Skorzeny, some who was the one who killed him. They went to his apartment and strangled him, took all his papers and everything, and then he was buried. I mean, he was a very old guy at the time, but they just ripped everything away from him. And this Otto was Adolf Hitler's bodyguard before. So it's the same small group of people that are just moving around, you know? And also, Alan Dulles was key in creating Operation 40 as well. So if we go back to some of the other members in this group, one, his name was José Perdomo. Now, most people have not heard this name, José Perdomo. But when John Lennon came home the evening, he was just about to do his major comeback. He came from the studio. He and Yoko Ono had just recorded the comeback album. And the man who's accused of the assassination, Mark Chapman, was standing to the right when the limo arrived to the Dakota building. This was in December 1980. Yoko Ono left the limo, and John left just behind her, just like 5-6 meters after her. Several shots were fired. John Lennon went down. Yoko came out screaming. John continued crawling into the building, but then collapsed and was taken to the hospital, later to pronounce dead. Now, when you look at this crime scene, like when I arrive to a crime scene, I always use what I call Farmer Brown logic. 1 + 1 = 2. It does not matter if you got a white robe and a long fancy title and you can prove things in 3D animation and in a super lab. If you say 1 + 1 = 37, I know that you are lying. And the reason you are lying will lead me to the motive, you know, because right. There is a reason for these lies, and that is to cover up the real truth. So you look at this crime scene with John Lennon, you see Mark Chapman was standing to the right. So, of course, John Lennon was shot 5 times from the right. Wrong. He was shot straight from the left. So you look at, okay, who was standing to the left? And this very evening, there was a doorman by the name of José Perdomo. Nice-looking gentleman.
One more time on the name, because sometimes Skype cuts right in there, and it always seems to happen right on the names. Can you give it to us? <I know. laughs> That's amazing.
His name was José Perdomo.
Okay. Carry
did
on.
You get that?
Yeah, I did.
Se perdomo. Okay. And this guy is often, I mean, I just heard his name the very first minutes after the shooting, you know, the first half hour he was mentioned on the reports. And then he just disappears in history, you know, as the doorman. And then he's not even mentioned. Now he's starting to surface again. But this Jose Perdomo, for 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40.
And now he's a doorman.
This evening, he was a doorman.
That particular evening, he goes from that position to the doorman. Okay, sure. Logical progression.
But the whole thing, what was he doing that? And what are the chances that shots are fired from the exact location where he is and that he's one of the top assassins in the U.S., you know? And then you have Mark Chapman, who's the guy who's still to this very day in jail for the whole thing. No motive, no nothing, no skill, standing in the wrong location. And who took the gun from Mark Chapman in the official story? Jose Perdomo. He was the one who went over and grabbed the gun from him.
Or put it in his hand?
The shots were not fired by Chapman at all.
No, I know, but would he have put the gun that did fire the shots into Chapman's possession?
Exactly. Get the prints on his hand. You know, the whole thing. So,
well, folks, I have to say we're just discussing the death of John Lennon on the verge of his comeback back in 1980, and we are also discussing the assassination of JFK, the team that put it together, and we're going to soon be discussing some other folks who are no longer with us due to nefarious means. Also, we are with Ulla Damagard, and we will be right back. Right. Mm-hmm. We're left with here's this Patsy again, which apparently is a great system to use because it always seems to work and people always tend to believe, enough people anyway, believe the official story. So there we have Mark David Chapman holding onto a gun put into his possession by the doorman. And this doorman we never really heard from again.
No, officially he died 6 years earlier, but he was there that evening. Go wonder. The reason why there's always a lone crazy guy, and I would suggest very much every single time you hear about a lone nut, a lone crazy guy, be aware, because this is one part of a template that has been used since the old Roman times all the way up to nowadays. The reason why they want him crazy, we're talking about a patsy. I mean, the assassination are always carried out by skilled, hard cold-blooded killers, you know, but the one that has to take the fall for it, that's the guy we're talking about. And the reason why they want him so-called crazy is because then there's no motive. He was just crazy. He went up and shot him. And the reason why they want him alone is that if there's more than one person involved in an assassination or trial, there is a conspiracy. Somebody has been there's a motive. They've been planning to carry out a violent deed against somebody else, and that is by law conspiracy. So they want him alone and crazy, so there's absolutely no reason to look into the case. Boom, you grab the guy, you stuff him away in jail, no trial hardly, boof, case closed, thank you very much, let's move on. Or he's shot dead on sight, or he commits suicide very conveniently or something like that. Standard procedure.
Right.
And I tell you, every single time I looked into a lone crazy guy, it's been an inside job.
Well, give us a few other, just you know, peripherally hit on some of the other lone crazy guys and the folks they killed, supposedly.
Okay, you got Sirhan Sirhan, Robert Kennedy. Okay?
Right.
With Sirhan Sirhan, the official story is that Sirhan Sirhan was in the kitchen when Robert Kennedy was escorted out. It was at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. And I just want to remind you, the assassination of Robert Kennedy was just 1 month after the assassination of Martin Luther King. There's only 1 month in between. And this was when suddenly the peace movement, the if you want to say the good guys, were suddenly gathering strength again after years of being totally knocked out emotionally after the JFK assassination. Then came the whole strength together, the Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were aiming to get very high up in maybe, I mean, it was, the door was almost open for Robert Kennedy to become the next president.
Oh, I think so. I think people would have voted for him, even just out of pure sympathy for the assassination of his brother.
For sure. And then you had Martin Luther King as a possible vice president, I would say, because he was also very, very powerful at that time. So first they took out Martin Luther, and they hoped, I think, to stop Robert, to scare him off, but he just carried on. And the evening he was shot, he had just won the primaries in California, and were set, you know, the road was straight towards the presidency. So anyway, what the story says is that Sirhan was standing in front of Robert Kennedy. The closest he was at any time was a bit more than a meter 30. He started shooting, and as soon as he started shooting, people jumped him, you know, and wrestled him. They put him down on a steam table, got the gun away from him and so on. Now, the gun carried 8 bullets. So, of course, how many shots were fired? About 13. 12, sure. 13. Okay. And, of course, Robert Kennedy was shot all the times. He was hit 3 times straight from the front. No, mm-hmm. He was hit from the back and to the right. And the last bullet that penetrated his skull just behind his ear was point blank. It was touching the skull when it was fired. So how is that possible? The answer is it's not. You don't. Many of these cases are no-brainers. You don't have to be very clever to see that it's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
But since we're being pumped with the official story, it's the patsy for years and years and years, we believe it.
Sure. I don't understand how this continues to happen with, you know, they'll say this about a person who has killed themselves, and then the means with which they claim he killed himself is ridiculous. Like this David Kelly guy that was testifying against the feasibility of even going into Iraq and back in the day. And next thing, he had a heart attack, but apparently he was cut open from the side. And, you know, people get shot in the back of the head and do crazy while their hands are tied. Is that supposed to be some kind of suicide? It's ridiculous.
And we buy it. You tell me, how asleep can we be? Or to put it in another way, how thick is it possible for us to be to keep buying into this? It's incredible. I've got... now on Friday here, since I'm for the first time in quite a few years, I'm on location here in Stockholm. So I'm offered to go like a guided tour around the assassination site of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, who was shot down by a lone crazy guy. Here we go again.
Sure.
In February 1986.
And you said this was 23 years after the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
And the same bunch of people killing the Swedish Prime Minister.
Not the same bunch. There were specific individuals that were part of it. But
okay.
I've identified everyone in the hit team, the walkie-talkie men, the backup shooters, the getaway drivers. They're all in my book, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, on my website, lightonconspiracies.com.
Okay, yeah, let's talk a second about how to get that while you're on that topic. This book is very well-researched, folks. Go ahead and try to parse through this and try to find a shaky bone in there. From what I've read, it's all pretty strong stuff, and I'm sure well worth the time put into it. Coup d'etat in Slow Motion by Ole Damgaard. That's O-L-E, and then Damgaard. Well, you don't say it how you pronounce it, or at least I don't anyway, but it's Damgaard. All right, so that's where you can find it. And we can get this on your – where do we find this book?
On lightonconspiracies.com.
Lightonconspiracies.com, all one word. Okay, carry on.
Unfortunately, it's only available as an e-book because nobody has dared to print it yet.
Oh, sure. I'm sure it's
– Michael Moore's agent had it for a few months, and he gave it back – to me saying that if you ever publish this, you're going to be sued from here to the moon. And about 6 months ago, there was an American publisher who took on the task. We signed the contract, everything, and just before it went into print, they canceled the whole thing due to technical problems, whatever that means.
Well, that's the whole reason, technical problems.
technical issues. There you go.
With a book, not even a Skype call.
No, okay. I know.
All right. Well, that sounds less plausible than the lone gut nun theory. So, all right.
But when they shot Robert Kennedy, Sirhan Sirhan, who is still in prison, once again, a totally innocent man, absolute, totally innocent. He had nothing to do with it at all. Still, his whole adult life, he's in prison because we have been so asleep and buying into these things, you know, with no use of our brains looking into these things. I think it's an absolute disgrace for all of us. We should look ourselves in the mirror and say, my God, we need to stop what is going on and not just follow along like brain dead sheep.
Well, it's so hard to it's so hard to get on top of these things now because there are so many more of them. You have planes being shot down. You have crazy guys. There's all kinds of lone nuts now beaking off in shopping plazas and McDonald's restaurants and all over the place. You know, the people say there's a lot of proponents of gun control, secret proponents of gun control, wanting to pepper the pot with these lone nut, you know, people that just kind of go off and kill a bunch of folks at a postal office or something. So it's getting even harder, I think, to keep track with this stuff. It's just become a normal part of fabric of society to listen to these crazy stories.
It's done by design. It's to distract you. And also these mass shootings, every single one I've looked into, and I have looked into a lot of them, every single one is an inside job, an absolute staged event. Many of them have not even occurred. They're staged event with actors nowadays. It's absolutely incredible. You can go to the websites like crisisactors.org, and you can apply there, and you can become one of them as well to take part of these things. But they're there. They use these old Roman templates. One of them is problem, reaction, solution. Because many of the agenda that this very brutal group is trying to force on the rest of the world would not be accepted had it not been for a problem. A terrorist, a boogeyman, a violent terror act or something like that. If they just pushed forward their agenda, they would be massive uprisings, problems, you know, guerrilla movements, all the demonstrations everywhere, boycotts.
Sure.
But if they secretly create a problem, and this is almost always a violent deed, a bomb, they love bombs, mass shootings at the moment, this is the trend, because these mass shootings are to get the guns away from normal people. That's the whole idea. It's not that there's a lot of crazy people around, that is the problem. No, it's the guns. They want people to give up their guns. This is why these mass shootings more or less only occur in the States, because that is where the population is armed, and they have a major problem with that.
Right.
So they secretly create a problem, a lone crazy guy starting shooting around. So to get their reaction, they always want the same emotional reaction from people saying, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then normal people turn towards the one they've elected to take care of these people, not understanding that I am the one who secretly created the problem. And then I would say, well, the only way I can deal with a mass shooting like this is, and then bam, 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 there comes the agenda.
Series of controls and checks and balances right on out of anybody being able to protect themselves as supposedly granted in the Constitution of the United States.
Yep.
Hmm.
And you can, when these things happen, you have to also to be aware of that media, to quite a large extent now, very big extent, I would say, is controlled through ownership and different structures around this whole thing by the same small elite group. They call themselves the elite. I call them the minority or the lightless.
Well, you're listening to this on Sirius XM radio right now, and hopefully you'll hear the rest of this interview. Just wanted to say that there is a company putting this show on the air right now, and hopefully they haven't been gotten to yet. We'll find out later.
I sure hope they haven't. But anyway,
I shouldn't have done that. I just can't believe I'm just sensitive to it, though, because there is a media company behind this show. And so far, I've been able to not have any kind of insertion of censorship or anything so far.
But that's absolutely wonderful. And I see that happening more and more because people are just waking up in the millions now. It's absolutely wonderful to see everywhere just popping up. So I think now is an absolute wonderful time to be alive, because this is when it's happening. We've been asleep for such a long time, letting this small group of people, because they're only a few thousand in total globally, and we're like 7 billion people. So it's an absolute joke that we are in this situation. But it's just like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. It's a very symbolic picture, I would say, of what's going on today. Is, you know, you got this tiny little girl with her dog, and the only thing she wants is to get back to where she came from, where everything was beautiful, where everything was in balance, no violence, no just beautiful harmony, all of this, which is what most of us want. Just let us get back to the way this beautiful, beautiful world was supposed to be. I mean, look at nature. It's designed for absolute balance and harmony and beauty. And then we have this small, like a cancer growth, that are just terrorizing the whole neighborhood globally.
Now, when you bring this up, let me ask you quickly about a lot of these operations, like Operation 40 and then Operation Paperclip. Operation I'm going to raise is Operation Mockingbird, which was the infiltration of several media points so that they could control the story. I'm not really convinced this has gone away.
Gone away? It's now more in place more than ever.
Operation Mockingbird specifically, like the direction of the media to go down certain roads, because I don't understand how we cannot seem to focus the media on the fact that some of the heavy players, as you say, in all of these very integral key turning points of our history, are the same people. I mean, any kind of bona fide media would pick up on this.
And that shows you exactly, you know, why are they not doing, why does normal people like me, I'm just an ordinary guy, why do I have to spend 30 years of my life looking into normal journalistic work or normal police work? Why has it not been done by the people who are paid for to do these kind of things, who are educated to do them? Why do we, the normal people, have to dig and risk our own life? I mean, I have people around me that have been murdered. I had to leave my home country because of this. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, why are they not doing it? And this shows you what's going on.
Well, they've managed to convince a lot of people.
How can these things
be covered up? Sure, they've convinced so many of us that, you know, to think outside the box on this issue and to assume that, or to reason that someone might have a profit and a motive and an ability to pull this up. Well, that's nonsense. They wouldn't do that. They, you know, people wouldn't hurt their own people in their own country. I just can't believe how that soup still goes down deliciously with so many people.
You know, Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda, minister of propaganda, he said that the bigger the lie, the easier it is to get normal people to believe it, if you just keep repeating it.
Well, that's another Nazi legacy that we are living. Wow, that is a bit of bad news, but I guess if we're awake to it, it's all the more helpful.
I think it's a very good idea to get awake, you know. The sooner the better, because things, they are not passive. They're moving forward. They're very active. And now they have high-tech technology, you know. And they try to control us more and more and more and more.
Well, let me ask you this. With your knowledge and your research on all of these different topics, and please take us where you'd like to after this question, but there is a matter of logistics that does kind of fascinate me. Now, what I'll say is this, that for there to be a group, as you said, Richard Nixon was instrumental in forming, that carries out these kinds of missions, and for them to reincarnate down the way, you know, involved with assassinating the Swedish leader, and on it goes, and you have an Operation 40, and you have an Operation Paperclip, and you have an Operation Mockingbird. Well, let's just go to that world for a second and think, even within those nefarious secret organizations, there must be some level of intergovernmental control of a body of people in there, and just in order to be able to pull these things off, you know. And there must be some same people at the helm or facilitators, just like you would have in a legitimate company that has an aspect of themselves that is involved in media advertising and another aspect involved in research for their product and another aspect involved in, you know, human resources personnel hiring for that company. There's a certain level of logistics to carry off any operation. And so is there some kind of intergovernmental secret kind of body that can control these things? Like, for example, they'd say, okay, well, we have a meeting in Davos coming up, and then there's another G20 thing going on, and somebody has to have a calendar events, you know, basic office spreadsheet stuff just to organize all this.
I mean, if you listen to Chip Tatum, who's been involved in quite a lot of these things, he said they had normal staff meetings, you know? And with these false flag operations, for instance, they like these false flag, these mass shootings, or if it's a bomb like in Oklahoma City or 9/11 or 7/7 or the Madrid bombings or so on. There's so many of them. What they did was they had just staff meetings. They set the whole thing up. Okay, how are we going to do this? What is it we want to accomplish? Okay, we need to, for instance, with the mass shootings in Norway. Norway was trying to get out of the whole NATO operation to stop the involvement. They didn't want to be part of these unjust wars going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. They wanted to pull out. So what did they do? They arranged this mass shooting in Norway, absolutely blowing the whole country to smithereens. Yeah, and so they had meetings before. How are we going to carry the whole thing out? Okay, we have going to have a drill, the mass shooting, this and this and this. And then what Chip has told me, he was not involved in the Norway thing, but he said that after they carried out the first operation, then they had a staff meeting right after, checking out, did we get the proper effect? Was that what we we were looking for? And if they didn't get that, then they would go in with a secondary operation, you will also see that happening quite often.
It's so frightening how banal that is. I mean, it's just like you're sitting around planning a community fundraiser. Let's make sure that Bill brings enough orange juice to sell, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's so almost boring at that point. These people could be so evil to sit there and plan these kinds of things as though they were, you know, like a community car wash or something.
But these people they don't have empathy. You know, it's just business. Business as usual. Nothing personal. We're just going to eliminate you. We're just going to blow you to pieces. I do not understand the mentality. I can only see their actions. I can see the planning, how they carry it out, how cold-bloodedly they just brutally murder people. You know, I do not understand how they function. But they look upon it as very, you know, doop-a-doop-a-doop. Yeah, what are you going to do tomorrow? Well, I have a meeting at Monday. We're going to plan this and this false flag. We're going to blow up this building and a couple of thousand people there. And then let's start the war in Laos again. Yes, thank you. Put that poof. You know, and if we can't carry it out on Tuesday, let's do it Thursday. I got a lunch appointment on Wednesday, so we got just going
to
cancel it.
Yeah, that part to me is like that. Even, yeah, it's even more eerie than the actual, you know, somebody was planning to kill somebody. Just the boring, behind-the-scenes, office-style nature of all of the orchestrating this and making sure it all happens. Oh, unbelievable.
Do you know, when you look at these people, I would say they're extreme cowards. Like people like Henry Kissinger, George Bush, and so on. Extreme cowards.
Is there a way we could get a test? Is there any way that as a public we could, you know, part of stepping up and you, as you say, waking up? I've always thought a good idea. This came up. It wasn't my idea. I saw it online years ago. But there needs to be some kind of – well, let's say if you were a leader of a – you know, a president of a trucking company or some kind of commercial venture along this line, it doesn't even matter. You want to make sure that the folks working for you are kind of on top of things. So if you're a trucking company, you don't want to hire somebody that's, you know, on drugs and taking all kinds of crazy pills and strange things. You want to make sure he's okay as an employee representing your company with your company logo on the side. So is there any way we as a society could demand that, say, if you're going to run for an elected office, that along with, say, maybe taking a blood test before you get married to check that that's okay. Is it okay if we take some kind of potential psychopath test Is there any way we could examine these folks and say, oh yeah, he passed the psychopath test, so he's not crazy, and we can go ahead and vote for this guy? Because talk about secrecy. The leader, supposed leader of Canada right now, this Stephen Harper, he's ruling with such an iron fist behind closed doors. First, he comes in on the scene and says, openness, you know, openness and accountability. This was one of his major platforms that he then almost immediately started to dial back on. They've passed laws, and he says, well, all Canadians believe that we should do this. And then the secret poll, say, commissioned by the Justice Department about prostitution and the new rules and the new laws. Of course, it's weighing in heavily against what he's saying, so we keep that one secret. And then there's another poll about the availability of people being able to use marijuana for whatever reason they'd like. And of course, the government of Canada holds a poll on this saying most people are okay with what the government thinks. And then, of course, that's not the answer. And on, talk about ruling with secrecy and not putting it on the table. Is there any way we can just say, before you run, before you get in the Republican primary, let's have like bona fide psychological evaluation of these people that I think mostly are psychopaths. I don't think we have a lot of psychopaths in the world, but I think a lot of them are at the helm of things. So can we test this?
Do you know the what the word government means?
Well, it's a, yeah.
It's Latin, and it means...
Ment means mind.
Yeah, governmente, mind control. That's
sure.
What it stands for. Here we are giving away our power to people that will tell us whatever we want to hear and then do whatever they want to do.
So I guess the answer is no, we can't stop them.
No, I think that would be an excellent idea. I think like just with Formula One race car stars and so on, put all the sponsors on their clothes so you see, okay,
sure.
Who are you representing?
That's right. I love it.
And then drug testing and minimum wages. The minimum wage would do a lot. Suddenly they would start get their butt in gear and do something good to get the whole thing going so that they would – because – do you know, I spoke to a guy here in Sweden once, because the more I was looking into the assassination of the Swedish prime minister, the higher up I got in the hierarchy of power here in Sweden, and it started going globally. At that point, I had no idea how big it was. And I said, but how? It seems like everybody on that level is corrupt. I said, how is that possible? And he said, the guy I spoke to, he was the former director of the Swedish custom officers. I mean, the national customs. So he was one of the big guys. He said, the only way to get to that level is by being corrupt. You have to prove your loyalty before you even have a chance to get up there.
Well, it sounds like any kind of way to evaluate them with a psychological test to see a psychopath test. Are you a psychopath? And maybe you can't run for office. If we could have something like this, but it seems to me that even if you were able to set something like this up, it would itself be corrupted and probably even more a tool for them to say, well, no, we passed the psycho test. Everything's good here because we didn't fudge the data at all. You know, it might not even be worth it.
I would say, how much is a government needed? Is it possible for us to live without a government? Is it possible to have a country working without a government? You could have all the basic functionalities, but without the without all this secrecy and all this behind the scenes and all these hidden Freemasonry networks, the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, all of these hidden networks, how to get out of them? Because they are not there for our best. It's the absolute contrary.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I put a lot of effort in my book, Coup d'Etat in Slow Motion. It's almost 1,100 pages. This is not because I like writing, because I do not, but because it is very, very complex what's going on, you know. And the last 200 pages are membership lists of the Bilderberg Group. Since they was created in 1954, the members that I've been able to track, and whatever agenda that has leaked out, and the secret locations. They have been changing location all the time, you know, every single year and so on. Because it's first when you start seeing how these key people in so many different countries are meeting in secrecy that you will see how it's all connected. How are they able to pull these things off through these networks?
Well, there's a trade deal going on right now in Europe, and Germany is apparently not really as interested in it as Canada. But all of the discussions about this trade deal that they're trying to work through, everything about it right now for Canadians is under wraps. We don't even get to hear about this until they pass it, and then they'll announce, oh, okay, here's what we came up with, and now here's what you have to live by. And they got to ram this thing through, you know, in secrecy, absolute secrecy.
And because of why? Why secrecy?
Because anybody would know.
It's because of national security. No, sure. It's not. It's because you're trying to hide from us what you're doing, you know, for your benefit, not for normal people.
Yeah.
I say transparency, number one, honesty, transparency, non-violence, non-greed, these beautiful old moral ethic values, these are the things we should go after. And then really start putting the spotlight on these people because we're talking major criminals here.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's have you go back and link us, put the 23-year gap together for us.
I go back to Operation 40 again.
Sure.
There's one man, his name was David Morales, or David Morales. He was one of the drivers of the getaway cars in Dealey Plaza. He was the one that drove, in my opinion, Ruth Payne's car and took some of the shooters from the Texas School Book Depository. There's plenty of shooters there. I can go through them all if you want later. But he was the driver that he was one of the key players in Operation 40, and he was at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was taken out, together with two other high-ranking CIA officials, one Gordon Campbell and the other one George Dionides. Okay, this David Morales was also in Bolivia together with Felix Rodriguez. Do you remember I pointed out Felix Rodriguez? He was the right hand of George Bush Sr. As a paymaster for Operation 40 and one of the key players in the whole Iran-Contra thing. He has also followed George Bush Sr. as at his right side all the time, over all the years. Anyway, they were given the task to track down Che Guevara in Bolivia. And Felix Rodriguez, together with a small group of soldiers and David Morales, managed to find him, tracked him down, and Felix Rodriguez ordered him executed. And the one who shot him was David Morales.
Huh.
So the same people in Dealey Plaza were at the Ambassador Hotel and also taking out Che Guevara. They were many of the members in Operation 40 was also in Chile on 9/11, 1973. They love these dates. 9/11 is one of their favorite dates. In 1973, when there was a very violent coup in Chile, when they overtook the elected president.
The Salvador democratically Allende, elected president, I know.
Salvador Allende, yeah. Together, this Operation 40 was down there together with Henry Kissinger, got rid of Salvador Allende and put Pinochet at the scene, you know. And then Operation 40 was very central in educating the Chilean soldiers, police force, and so they were trained in torture and killing, executing people, and so on. They were also very key in Operation Condor. There's quite a very good film, I must say, with Robert Redford, called Operation Condor, where the whole thing is that they use that to track down supporters of Salvador Allende and get rid of them globally.
Right.
One of the people they got rid of was Orlando Letier in Washington at Embassy Row, where they blew him up with a car bomb. This was the biggest national terror act before 9/11. So a major thing. And the guy that delivered the explosives for that bomb was James Files, the shooter behind the picket fence. He picked up the explosives in the Dominican Republic, brought it to Washington. The guy who put together the bomb, his name was Orlando Bosch, also called Dr. Death, Operation 40 again. He was in Dealey Plaza when JFK was killed. And the guy that pulled the trigger to blow the whole thing up, his name was Michael Vernon Townley. Michael Vernon Townley was, I'm sorry I go all over the globe, I'm just trying to show you these people,
sure,
how involved they are.
Can I just say right now, before you get going, keep on that note, but I am looking at Operation 40 here, and on our good old friend Wikipedia, which is always full of laughs, it says that the whole operation was approved by Eisenhower, and then it goes on to describe this. It says that it was presided over by Nixon, like you say, and then it says the group included Frank Sturgis, and then in brackets it says, who would later become one of the Watergate burglars. And then it says Felix Rodriguez, and then in brackets it says a CIA officer who later was involved in the capture and summary execution of Che Guevara. Like, it goes on and on, puts these little things in brackets like it's no big deal. Like, don't notice the web of interconnectivity here, you know. Unreal. So, yeah.
I tell you, before I started mentioning Operation 40, I couldn't find anything hardly about this. Now suddenly it pops up everywhere. I don't know, coincidence or not. I just know that this information has been buried deep, and now it's just coming up to the surface. So I see that as it's a good step forward. At least it's there, even though it's in brackets.
Sure. Yeah, it's just Wikipedia tries to, you know, it gets edited by all kinds of people, and they try to expunge salient facts all the time.
I know.
All right, so sorry for cutting in there, but I just can't believe the scope of this.
Anyway, this Michael Van Townley, he was the one involved in blowing up Orlando Letier. He was also involved in the murder, a political hit in South Africa. A very, very respected man called Robert Smith and his wife were assassinated down there. Then they went to Italy and they shot down Bernardo Leighton and his wife. They were supporters of Allende as well. So these were shot down there. They were also in Chile. They were killed, Carlos Prats, General Carlos Prats. And this Michael Vernon Townley was also on location in Stockholm in 1986 when the Swedish Prime Minister was taken out. He was later given, he was taken, what do you call it, the FBI witness protection program. And that's the last thing I heard of him. You know, he was covered by them. And also, every single time that people in Operation 40 has been arrested or something, for instance, Orlando Bosch, the guy I explained before who put together the bomb for the car bomb in Washington, in my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, just to show what type of people we are dealing with, I put in just the things that he was sentenced for. And I tell you, it's page up, page down, page up, page down, page up, page down of bombs. You know, they blew up everything from airliners to shops to whatever that had to do with Cuba. We're talking hundreds and hundreds. And then once he was put in jail, he was pardoned. And by whom?
The outgoing president.
Not George Herbert Walker Bush. Do you really think so? Yes, we do.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's what they do on the final day of their presidency, apparently. They sign a bunch of papers to get some friendly criminals out of trouble.
Yeah, but not only that. I tell you, if I'm correct, I'm putting 30 years of my life into this statement. When JFK was killed in Dealey Plaza on the 22nd of November 1963, that was the last real elected president. From then on, the I don't know what to call them, the group of ruthless killers that killed him took over that day, and the whole long row of precedent that has followed belongs to the same group. Not that they were part of the assassination, but they're just a different phase of the same very brutal war machine that took over that day in November 63.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense. A committee has established itself, say, and they've gotten rid of the last wild card that wasn't leaning the way they wanted to lean, and everybody now into the system is going to meet their approval before he hits the hustings.
They, they don't even get to that level without being improved on. And they're just another face, another face, another face. That's why nothing changes. You want to vote for me or me or me? Doesn't matter. Three different faces of the same machine.
Yeah. Or vote for change. That's the one I like. Let's vote for change because we need to change it from 3 years later as if it's any kind of different. Some of the stuff Obama has signed and done and said are things that had George Bush, his predecessor, said, people would have got really up in arms. Oh, it's another Republican attack on, you know, this and that. But Obama gets to do it, and there's not as much of a problem.
Because also they did it with a PSYOP, I would say. You know, Obama was, as far as I've been able to find out, what happened was that we're back to this problem reaction solution. You create a problem to get a reaction from the public so that you can come with a solution. Mm-hmm. And once they had worn out Boy George, I mean, they really started speeding it up in the end, you know, more war, more war, more war. So in the end, people were just like, we need to stop it. We need to stop it. We need to stop it. We're not going to look at anyone. You know, we're not going to check anything out. And boom, in came like a rock star, this man, Barack Obama, who I promise you no one had heard about a year or two before. He came from absolute nowhere. He came in on the stage with the whole shebang. He was named president, the best president ever, even before he was even elected. He was given the Nobel Peace Prize for things to come.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, how rigged can it get, you know? And also, when you look at the Nobel Peace Prize, who was Nobel? He was the inventor of dynamite, you know? So no wonder if it had been like a Mother Teresa's Peace Prize or something like that. But here is the Nobel.
Wow. Okay.
But can I say, do you remember the series 24?
A television show. Yeah, I have to admit, I haven't seen it. I know what it's about. It's about a CIA op or something. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's Keith Sutherland.
Right.
I truly believe that they did a PSYOP here, you know, to prepare the mind of the population. Because just a few years ago, just the thought of a black president was absolutely impossible for most people. Then you had 24. During the time when George Bush Jr. was just going for it full speed ahead, creating this massive, my head is going to blow soon if something is not going to be done. That type of reaction.
Right.
In came 24. And what was 24 about? It was this FBI operative, Keith Sutherland, who was working for this amazing president. Absolutely
a great guy.
Stunning.
Is he a great guy in this show?
Oh, he's the best. You love him. He comes in, black man, beautiful man, beautiful voice, he was so strong. He had all the morals. He had all the ethics. There was just like, we are going to stand for what is right and what is true and all the beauty thing, you know, you just want to love this guy.
Okay.
The whole first series, he is like that. And you just fall in love with him. I tell you, that actor could have been elected. He was just amazing. Whatever the problem was, he stood up for what is, you know, all the beautiful things. Then came the second series. Oh, due to national security, we have to torture this guy. I'm very sorry, torture him. Okay. And in the second one, it started with all this Muslim, you know, the boogeyman. More and more and more, the Muslim boogeyman. Ooh, ooh, ooh. And the third one, he was totally out of control. But by then, I think after the first series, the subconscious of the population was like, so open to the idea, and then woof, in on stage came Barack Obama, who by the way seems to be a totally constructed identity. I mean, it seems like he's not even a real person. His real name is Barry Soetero, a former CIA operative who they put together to fit in so that it would just fit everyone.
So sorry, I'm not so up on this television show, but I just want to go back to it for a second. It did come out in the early 2000s. Right around the Bush presidency starting, and at that time, that's when the president was this black, wonderful man. at the very beginning, like years before Obama. Okay, just want to make sure.
This is, that, you know, they pave the road, you know, they prepare the road. This is not, this, you can see that in a lot of documents that has leaked out over the years, how they prepare, they almost, it's almost like playing chess, you know. They have like a, who are we going to use for this next operation?
Right.
Oh, we're going to pick him. We're going to use that one. We're going to, just like chess, you know, jup. Okay, this operation and what is needed for the next move. And I believe they do this with presidents as well.
Hmm. Wow. All right. Well, let's go back to the tie-in between this gang of shady, malevolent people that were involved in the JFK assassination that later were highly responsible for the Swedish assassination of Olof Palme in 86.
I'll give you another direct hit. When you see the motorcade when it turned down Houston Street and then do this awful, awful turn down Elm Street, the 120 degree that just blocks the whole motorcade, slowing it down so it's perfect, a perfect circuit shoot for all of the shooters. You got this very infamous umbrella man, you know, the guy with the black umbrella?
Sure.
Most people, there's been a lot of speculation saying, oh, he had a poison weapon or something like that. I would strongly suggest that his task was to point the cross, the point for the crossfire, you know. That is the exact point where all the shooters, wherever they were located, should start shooting, because they couldn't have... they couldn't blame it on one patsy if people heard like 25 shots being
right.
fired up. So everybody had to be fired at the same time. So they could be said, yeah, but it was echo here and because of the buildings and so on.
Mm.
So, and as far as I know, his name was Roy Hargraves. He was a mercenary closely connected to Operation 40, not a real member, but very closely to it. In a group called Interpen that was very connected to that. Anyway, he was the one showing where everybody should start shooting. And right in front of him, there's a dark-skinned guy who steps out in the streets waving, almost like as he's trying to slow down the car even more. Now, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. Felipe Vidal Santiago. Member of Interpen as well, closely connected to Operation 40. He later worked for many years under the alias of Charles Morgan for a CIA front cover aid company called ITT. And he, 23 years later, in the fall of 1985, I just have to rewind the tape, his task for many of the years were when an assassination was carried out in a country in, for instance, Africa or wherever, one of his tasks was to go there and recruit people as patsies or people as a local backup and so on. And in the fall of 1985, just a few months before the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, he was in Sweden, in Stockholm, trying to recruit two different shooters in Stockholm under the alias of Charles Morgan, working for ITT.
Mm.
You know, so we're back to the same people. So what does that say? If it's the same team of assassins, it would be very likely that it would be the same people giving the order as well, when you can see that the same team of assassins has been used for so many other hits by the same people giving the order.
Yeah, with this repeated rap sheet that so many of these people are involved in so many of the same operations, it goes against the official story also, because as soon as they find someone who's legitimately kind of bad at doing something in different schemes, well, they get locked up and, you know, maybe executed if they're in the progressive state of Texas or Florida. But these guys keep popping up over and over and over in different countries and different timelines, but it's the same bunch of merry men. They must have some kind of protection.
Total protection. They're untouchables. And yeah. They know it. That's why you can track them, because they move very openly. They're not afraid of getting caught. They know they can get away, you know.
And do we have any deathbed? Do we have any deathbed confessions from any of these folks at all? Anybody that's kind of turned it around? I can speak briefly to Robert McNamara in the Errol Morris documentary called "The Fog of War," and he admits to, you know, being back in Kennedy's time, you know, launching this whole fake situation that became going into Vietnam. And he kind of backs up on it in the latter days of his life. Do we have anybody else on that line who has confessed to this kind of thing?
Plenty. And E. Howard Hunt was one of them. He named quite a few of these people that I mentioned as well. But it's only when people start, you know, dying or just before they die, they start talking. And this is one of the reasons why they die often, you know, when they start, I don't know if they feel guilty about it or if they start becoming too big-headed and start speaking too openly about it. Because very often when they start naming names, they're out, you know.
Right.
So there's another guy who was involved in the Swedish assassination. His name was Stefano Della Chiaia. He was also known as the King of Terror. He was responsible and sentenced for the train bombing in Bologna, where they blew up, I think it was 280 people in Bologna in Italy. And he was involved in so many assassinations. He's still around to this very day. He's published his own book. He's also, when we look into these secret networks, there's one group called the Committee of 300. It's a group where they got very strange occult things, but it's also a group with the agenda of centralizing the banks globally into one central bank. That is one of their main things. And among the members, I've got that on my website as well. If you want to become a member, there's all of these details. When you look at the membership list of this group, there are people like Bill Gates, many royalties, many high-ranking people up there in the scales. And next to Bill Gates, guess who? Stefano Della Chiaia. I mean, this mass murderer. It is mind-blowing once you get into this world. And Stefano Della Chiaia was working for Franco, the dictator of Spain, before. He was doing a lot of things here, or in Spain, killing a lot of people there. And he was also working side-by-side with Klaus Barbier. Do you know Klaus Barbier? He was called the monster from Lyon, I think.
That's right. Yeah. Was he the one that also killed his wife?
No. That I don't know for sure, but he looked like a very gentle person, but he was an absolute monster in the concentration camps and so on. He was later very central in South America, where he was working together with Michael Townley and Stefano Della Chiaia when it comes to teaching out how to torture people, and very charming people. But it's just unreal when you start seeing these so-called monsters sitting side by side with people that you see on TV every day looking very nice and decent, and people like Bill Gates and his wife. Once you start looking into their agenda, it starts getting very smelly as well. You know, there's this official version, and then you go behind the curtain and it's just like, oh my God, what is going on?
Let me ask you this, because you say, and I agree, we have to wake up to a lot of these things and understand that we're being played like fools on so many levels. But before the internet, what was your kind of methodology to be able to research all of these things and get folks' names? I mean, were you spending a lot of time in a library, or how did you go about it back then? Before, I mean, I'm sure you do these same things now as well as the internet. You can't just rely just on the internet, but it is a great tool. How did you cover this stuff before, like in the earlier part of the 30-year dig, the first 20 years of it or something?
It was a very scary time in my life because before the internet, if you knew too much, if you were the one with this information and you were the only one, so easily that you could just become part of statistics, you know, end up in a bathtub, fully dressed, having drowned in your sleep, as they said, or shooting yourself in the back of the head with a shotgun, right, or being hit by a car. I tell you, I've got one case here in Sweden, a high-ranking police officer who stabbed himself. This is the official story to this very day. Stabbed himself 15 times and then hit himself in the face with something very hard that looked like a bat. You know?
Well, that's dedication to the cause.
This is suicide. It is one of the highest, pathologists here in Sweden. who has signed off this case as a suicide.
And who is this fellow that did took his life in this strange manner?
Okay, his name was Gösta Trysberg, and he was one of the officers of a very, very Nazi group of police officers here in Stockholm. Very central in the assassination of Olof Palme, as the local backup. They were called the Baseball League. And he, this Gösta Trysberg, was a very decent, very honest man, and brave as well. And he was very, very concerned that this group of extreme Nazis, we're not talking like gentle Nazi, we're talking like Sieg Heil,
right.
Kill the Jews. They had dogs that if you said the name Olof Palme, it started barking and you're going totally wild. They were using pictures of his face to target practice and this type of thing, doing the Sieg Heil thing in the station. He was getting very worried about that and tried to stop it. And then he was first harassed in many ways. He lost his police license. They took away his gun. And then one day when he went out to check the mail, he and his wife was home alone. He never came back. And she went out and found him dead in the snow. Wow. Stabbed 15 times, and then and even his family, until I met them, thought that it was a suicide. I mean, how, I don't know how you can believe that, because 15 times, can I just demonstrate?
Sure.
It's like, I'm now going to stab myself 15 times because I'm very depressed. Okay, here we go.
Here's
one, two, three, four, five. I need to rest. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Oh, my God, I'm feeling like I'm dying. 13, 14, and here comes the final, 15. And then I will hit myself in the face. I mean, you can't even do it. You cannot do it. Even if you're very determined and a ninja or something like that, you wouldn't be able to pull it off. And still, this is the official story. I've got the documents in the book as well, the autopsy protocol, the whole thing, you know.
So I have to ask, though, I mean, if a person were to take their own life, there are ways to do it with a knife in that way, and certain attack points that you would get. And some people have done this over the course of history. So why wouldn't you make it a little more feasible and sort of cut somebody up in that manner than try to convince everybody that this guy shot himself in the head, in the back of the head, with his left hand, with his other hand tied up, you know, with stabbing himself 50 times, these ridiculous scenarios. Why do they even go there? Is it kind of an in-house joke? Let's see how crazy we can make this thing and get people to believe it. It seems to me there must be some other level of play going on with these people, because why wouldn't you just make it seem like a bona fide looking hanging or something that people actually do?
I think we're responsible. I mean, we have been buying all of these absolute incredible lies for such a long time. So why should they even bother, you know, to try and be careful?
Well, I guess so. Yeah. So
you got the, can I just say a small example?
Mm-hmm.
You got the Pentagon, the most protected building in the whole of the world, I would say, with so many cameras.
Oh, sure. It's safe. It's very safe.
All of them were turned off this very day. And a massive big plane comes and just disappears into a small little hole. And the official story to this very day is it vaporized due to high heat.
Uh-huh.
If I wrote to my insurance company, I said, you know, I reversed my car into the wall and it vaporized due to the friction. Do you think they would believe me?
Yeah, no, that's amazing.
And this is what we are buying. This is just one example of so many.
And the suitcases and the teeth and the carry-on luggage and everything else completely disappeared. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
And it's still to this very day.
Into the one-fifth wall of the Pentagon that had been structurally readjusted somehow relatively recently.
And do you know the office that was hit? Do you know who was working there?
No.
Okay, the day before 9/11, I also want to say that 9/11 on the exact date 10 years earlier, the 9/11 in 1991, if you like numbers, there's only ones and nines, George Bush Sr. went out, and that is when he held his first New World Order speech.
That, oh, sure.
The exact date, 9/11, 10 years earlier, before 9/11.
Yeah, that was in the Iraq invasion, the Kuwait, you know, that whole situation with Saddam Hussein.
But then the day before 9/11 in 2001, let me see here.
Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah, came out and said, listen, we have a problem here. We're very, very sorry, but we lost, was it 2.3
trillion?
Do you know how many zeros that is?
Yeah, I left it under the rug. I don't know where it went.
No, and he was very concerned. We're very, very sorry. We're going to really, 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 really look for them and so on. And then the very next day, the office that was hit by this massive plane, they claim, was where the people were working trying to find out where this money had gone.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So all the people killed there were people looking into this or people responsible for it.
Well maybe that's a coincidence, you know, maybe that's...
Of course it is.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, my God, do you think I'm a conspiracy theorist?
It's hard not to be sometimes. It's hard to be a true theorist. Now, let me ask you, when you've got the other side of the coin here, you've done a lot of research over the years. So when a particular intense world event takes place and we report, you decide, Fox News comes on and interviews you and gives you some time on the floor with Sean Hannity, how does that usually go?
I did not understand the question. Could you please repeat that?
Well, I'm being a bit sarcastic, but I'm saying when, you know, there's organizations such as Fox News and they claim to be, we report, you decide. So I'm just wondering, you've probably been on the show there giving another point of view and talking about your intense research as opposed to somebody that's just a blow-dried head reading things off a cue card. So when you, have you ever been on such a program and been trying at least to offer the other side of the story, you know, and they kind of knock you down. Have you ever been into that mainstream media where they try to paint you up like some kind of kook?
Nope. I've never, ever been invited.
Never been invited. Well, you've done a lot of research. I mean, some of the people that come on there, they don't hardly have any research history, or perhaps they are a former military person explaining why this next venture is going to be so good for us. There doesn't seem to be ever... somebody with the other side of the story. I don't know what you think of him. Perhaps a Noam Chomsky coming onto a Fox discussion. It's always these people with vested interests.
I rest my case. I mean, this is the whole thing. Do you know, with this Swedish assassination, to this very day, the stories in the newspaper is, was it the Patsy? Was it not? Was it the Patsy? Was it not? And then they have some theories coming up and down and up and down. But that's the whole thing. But in my book, I name all the people. I track down all the agents, foreign agents, mercenaries, how the weapons were delivered, getaway cars, how they were flown in, out, money, you name it. It's in that book. So what have I done? I emailed it to most of the major newspapers, to many of the key people in government position and so on, and said, please, I'm here. Use me. Use this knowledge. I spent 30 years. A major part of the truth is in there. Have I been contacted by one single? No. I was invited by a private group of people in Denmark for the Bilderberg meeting that just took place in Copenhagen here in June. I was, of course, as one of the key speakers outside the meeting, not inside. Okay. And right. Before I went up there, I had 1,100 email addresses for media contacts in Denmark. I emailed them, said, I'm coming to Denmark. I'll be happy to give you my book. Whatever you need, whatever way I can assist you, I'm right here. Use me. Let's dissolve this mystery once and for all. Let's get it out in the open, and let's move to a brighter future. How many people answered me? Two. How many people turn up? One. Out of 1,100 emails.
Yeah.
What is going on? You see?
Even the fallacy of having a news gathering organization in general seems to be a fallacy at this point. If they're not going to at least investigate what you're saying, they say, well, this guy, we don't really know him, but he says he's worked on it for 30 years. Let's ask him some questions. No, you don't get that.
Thank you, Alan. That would be a logical thing. Meet me. Say, I'm sorry, he's full of it. And then
sure.
Say bye-bye. Fair enough. I mean, I used to work as a journalist. I also used to work, I did music for TV4, national TV here in Sweden. And there was one documentary about the assassination of the Swedish prime minister made by some West German normal people. One was a cab driver, the other one was some kind of film guy. They made a documentary called Murder in Stockholm. Absolute beauty of work, low budget, absolute fantastic work, is pointing out a certain part of the truth, not the whole truth, but a certain part, very clearly naming names, putting pictures of people, of some of the these Nazi police officers. That was the Swedish part of the whole thing. They were not the ones carrying it out, but they were the local backups, and they were used as walkie-talkie men and so on. Absolute stunning work. This documentary won Documentary of the Year in Italy and in Germany, I think, these two countries. So was it shown in Sweden? No. So I got a tape with it, and I went to the people. I mean, since I had access to TV4, I went into the – they have a special program called Cold Facts, you know.
Okay.
And so I went in there and said, listen, guys, I didn't know them personally, but I had this tape. I just said, listen, this is a documentary. It's won all these prizes, and it's about the Swedish assassination, this of Olof Palme. I said, can I please leave it here, and then you please have a look at it, and you decide. And he said, the man in charge there, he said, so is it about the Patsy? I said, no. It's about a conspiracy behind it involving Swedish police. He said, well, in that case, we're not interested because we have decided company policy that this is the way we're going to go. There's too many theories out there.
That is the exact opposite. And so many of these things I've noticed, you know, this type of opposite that is sold to us as the truth. You can't decide where the thing is going to go and then follow along that way and claim to be objective. You have to go and get all of the facts and see where they lie and then make your decision.
Thank you, Ellen. Look at the tape. For God's sake, look at it. Then decide, my God, it's just a load of crap.
Yeah.
We would never air this. Or, my God, this is incredible. But look at it. If you call yourself a journalist, look at it. At least, and these were top-level investigative journalists. With the job, their task was in Sweden to track down things like this.
Yeah, it's amazing. I, for people that are having a tough time with this, I mean, I try to put it this way as simply as possible. If you're new to the show or to Ulla's work, imagine having a series of ingredients on the kitchen counter. Let's say, you know, some chocolate, some milk, some eggs, etc., and various bits of flour. And you say to yourself, right, I'm going to look at all these ingredients here, and then I'm going to make a lasagna. And you're like, well, how are you going to do that? Well, these are the ingredients that I'm using. I'm going to come up with a lasagna. Isn't it more likely that with that particular list of ingredients, you're going to wind up with a cake? You know, that's how crazy it is to me.
I can only say that I've spent so many years being totally flabbergasted. You know, I've been sitting with my chin in my knee, just like, oh my God, what is going on, you know?
Well, it's tough because I just saw an article the other day where there were some people polled. Now, Life magazine has some commemorative issue with Ronald Reagan on the cover, like he's some kind of great guy. And it's a pictorial sort of love letter to, I guess it's the 10th anniversary of his death or something. I've read some people that, you know, you're trying to get people to keep up with where you are, Ola, in the way of research. I mean, some folks apparently don't even know that Reagan was shot, regardless of who did it. So if you're that behind and you're that clued out that, you know, that kind of thing happened and why it might, never mind why it happened, these folks didn't even know that it happened. It's amazing.
And do you know who, you know, John Hinckley, the guy who was accused of having shot Reagan, do you know where he was the night before?
I do, but I'd like you to tell everybody.
He was invited for dinner at the Bush residence.
Yeah. The timing there is amazing. Just like they were having a meeting, Bush and some other folks, on the day of 9/11 with some of the Saudis in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in New York. On the day of.
The Bin Laden family members.
Yeah. On the
it's
day
not
of the
just anyone. And the only plane that was left to that was allowed to leave that day was the plane with these people, you know, and family members. So coincidences again. There's plenty of them, but well, they're pointing the same direction.
Let's take it to the music world again a little bit. What is the tie-in with John Lennon? And let's say even you've got some thoughts on the great reggae legend Bob Marley and his, let's call it an early demise as well. Are there, what is the story with the music industry and why would these people be taken out of the picture? What was the big deal about getting rid of John Lennon and then even if that's what your story is, a Bob Marley assassination?
I tell you, I think when you look at this global elite, their agenda is death and destruction, making multiple billions of dollars with drug, pedophile gangs, weapons, oil, not caring at all if they destroy the whole world. And then their enemies are beautiful, beautiful individuals who stand for peace, unity, brotherhood, let's embrace, let's take care of each other. These are the people that are a boil in the butt for them, and that they need to get rid of in their point of view. That is why people like Gandhi was taken out, Lady Di, Bob Marley, John Lennon, JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. Most of them, if not all, were standing for a beautiful future, you know, and then this is why they were taken out. And John Lennon was just about to make his major comeback. There was a big peace tour planned for both the States and Europe, as far as I know. And the thing is that if you're just an ordinary guy in the street, nobody really listens to you. But if you're someone like John Lennon and you say, let's not go to war anymore, let's stay home, it's all rigged, it's all, you know, they don't care about you at all. This is all about greed and oil and drugs and all. Then people listen.
Right.
Lady Di, why was she taken out? Because she stood up and talked against landmines. She was the one of the most, if not the world's most known woman. And she was reaching out to such a big part of the population globally that normally didn't care about politics or anything like that. And when she started talking out against landmines, which is a major part of the agenda of one of the tools for this machine of death and destruction, she became a major target and they took her out.
And again, easily fooling the public. I mean, people were so outraged to think that you could suggest that the royal family might have anything to do with this, that any kind of overlying interest. It was just an accident, they say. And, you know, the guy was drunk who was driving. It was just an accident. And then when you suggest that the royals might have some hand in this, people, well, that's ridiculous. However, don't you think it's funny, Ola, that through time, let's say with the plays of William Shakespeare and actual malevolence and crime and poisonings and all kinds of things that have gone on, that we do agree have taken place in the royal family all through the years. This has been going on. And then they've been killing each other, working themselves into positions of power, having infighting with the royal families, killing people all the time. They got a huge history of this, hundreds of years, probably longer. And all of a sudden, this princess, who you say was poised to bring focus to landmines and let's reverse that, she gets killed. No one wants to believe that maybe someone on the end, because they don't do that anymore. You know, that's all history. That's all Shakespeare. That's all plays and movies. But when it really comes up, they immediately wipe the royal family clear of even being a potential suspect. It's just astounding.
I tell you, when you start looking into the royal family, oh my God. Oh my God. I just want to point out also that on the 31st of March this year, 2014, the former Pope, other people involved as well, and Queen Elizabeth II of Windsor were subpoenaed to a court in Brussels, a people's court, but of international lawyers, international judges. The whole scenario was there. She was subpoenaed together with a former pope for child genocide. These are not lightweight accusations, you know. And the trial has been carried out. I don't want to go into the details how it turned out, but it's they're not untouchable anymore, you know. The same a few years ago, there was a similar court in Kuala Lumpur where one of the judges were lawyers were from Canada, Alfred Labremont Fabre, where they tried George Bush Senior, Dick Cheney, no, sorry, Junior, Dick Cheney. And Tony Blair for crimes against humanity, crimes against peace. They were all sentenced for these war crimes. They were the whole cases. Of course, they didn't have the balls to turn up. Neither did Queen Elizabeth. Just a week before whole court case was about to start, she went out in the press and said, "Due to high age, I won't be able to travel anymore." I would say, Elizabeth, could it have anything to do with the court case in Brussels? Just a suggestion. Anyway, Boy George, Tony Blair, and Dick Cheney were all sentenced for that. And the sentence was delivered to the War Tribune in Hague, where it's still active. So the thing is, it's falling down. It's cracking down around them. So I think it's a beautiful time to be alive. I tell you.
Let's hope that picks up the pace, you know.
Because the thing is that these people are involved in so much of the mayhem that is going on. We think that we live in a crazy world full of violence, full of crazy terrorists, full of cars, you know, bombs and mass shootings and all of these things. And the prices are going wild inflation is going wild and society is going down and nature is going totally mad. I tell you, when this small group, we're only talking about a few thousand, when they stop manipulating the rest of us, this world automatically will just lift to a level that is way beyond it, where it's been for a long, long, long time. And I would suggest that this is the first time in hundreds of years where humanity will be given the chance for the first time to see what can we do, how can we make this a beautiful world for all of us to live in, you know. And this will be the responsibility for all of us. How are we going to get along? How are we going to deal with this now that we're not manipulated anymore? Can we do it, and in what way?
So that was the message of Bob Marley as well, was love and peace and you know. It was the same kind of thing. He was the reggae kind of same version that John Lennon was the rock version of, and that these other people, you know, let's kill Gandhi. Oh. Let's kill Gandhi. That's a good idea. Let's get him out of the way. This little man, you know.
No, but with Bob Marley, it was slightly different because Bob Marley, he grew up, he had a black mother and a white father. His father was one of the owners of a plantation that he never – so he grew up as a, what do you call it, a mixed blood, like a mulatto. Mm-hmm. And he was not accepted either by the black or the white. So he was having a very hard childhood. But he also grew up as a very strong individual, I think, due to this. And the way out for him was through music. He found out that through music and his lyrics, that was the way that he could reach people and be accepted and so on. And these lyrics and so that he wrote made him a very popular person, a very strong individual and highly respected on Jamaica.
And around then the world.
But that came later. Then in 1975, the CIA had been targeting country by country by country in South America and Latin America and so on. And in 1975, Kissinger went over to Jamaica. And they had targeted this island to take over the whole thing. And anyway, what they did was they flooded the whole island with lots of weapons, drugs, hard drugs, not, you know, marijuana these days, but cocaine, crack, not crack, but very hard drugs. And they, it got to a point, they started all this violence, they started fires, they burnt down industrial complexes and stuff like that. And it came to a point where there were martial law on Jamaica. At that point, somebody approached Bob Marley and asked, can you please come and help us unite the country again? Because it's going totally out of hand. So he accepted, and he was going to a concert where he was going to be the one to try and calm down the whole thing. But everybody was warning him, you're going to be killed, they're going to shoot you, you're not safe. But Bob, he was totally determined, have I said yes, then I'm going to do it. So they were rehearsing for this big concert, and then at the same time, there was a hit team delivered on the island. And as far as I've been able to find out, one of the guy in charge of this hit team, his name was Luis Posada Carrillas. He was one of the members of Operation 40. Surprise, surprise.
Oh, another guy.
He was also present in Dealey Plaza, not as a shooter, but he was there just as Orlando Bosch. He was also involved in hundreds of different terror acts over the years. And he was there on Jamaica when this hit was done on Bob Marley. So what they did was this team came up to the house where they were rehearsing. Bob and his wife and his manager was in the kitchen just having a smoke and so on. And somebody just pulled up the door and started shooting in, totally wild. So Bob Marley's wife was hit in the back of the head. His manager was hit five times, four in the stomach and one in the groin or something like that. And Bob had a bullet that touched his chest but lodged in his arm. So he was just a centimeter from being killed. Anyway, the shooters left and they were lying there in their own blood. They got them back in together. And Bob, still after this, was totally determined to do this concert. So he went there, and with a bandaged arm and everything, they came very late, but the whole island just went wild when he came up there, and he played the whole concert and so on. And in the end, he managed to get the two leaders of the two parties on the island up on stage, shaking hands, you know, so it's incredible. Then, just a few days after this concert, he was. They were still very afraid that he was going to be assassinated. So he was surrounded by machete carrying Rastafaris, you know.
Right.
And so there was this American who approached him, asking if he could please, if it would be possible for him to make a documentary about Bob Marley. And Bob was. He said, "Yeah, no problem. I'll join you to do that." And as a gesture and a thank you, he was given a pair of cowboy boots. There was a
Bob Marley was given the boots, you mean? Or
yeah, Bob Marley was given a pair of cowboy boots just as a thank you. And there was a photographer, his name was Lee Lu Lee or something like that, Lee Lu Lee. He's an award-winning photographer. And he was there when this thing went down. And he said that when Bob was very much into jeans and boots and, you know, this always very, very fit. So he was very happy to receive these boots. But when he pulled one of the boots on, he just cried out. And when he pulled off the boot, they pulled out like a piece of copper wire that was stuck inside the boot. And that is the one that punctured his big toe, where he later created cancer or evolved cancer, developed cancer.
Wow.
Now, who was this documentary maker would be a good question, I would say.
They gave him the boots. Yeah, sure.
Who gave him the boots? I'm not saying that he was I'm not saying that he was aware of what was inside the boot, but his name was Carl Colby, and he was the son. He is the son of former CIA director Bill Colby.
Oh, no. What's his name? Carl Colby?
Carl Colby, yeah.
Oh. These folks are all interconnected. Isn't that strange?
That's what I'm saying, Alan. I'm not making these things up. It's just like, oh, my God, again? And do you know Carl Colby, where he lived? Do you know where he was living?
I don't know. The White House.
No. He was in Los Angeles. He was the neighbor of Nicole Simpson.
Oh,
OJ,
our friend who was murdered by somebody and pinned on OJ or was OJ. Yeah. But anyway, she's gone.
Anyway, and Carl Colby and his wife, Nancy, I think her name is, they both gave testimony about how OJ Simpson had abused Nicole. So they're very central in this case as well. Coincidence? I don't know. But it's sort of like these people just keep popping up in very odd places, I would say.
Yeah. Well, wasn't George Bush Sr. supposed to be in Dallas the day that Kennedy was shot?
He was in the Daltex building.
And even if he had nothing to do with it, which I doubt, but even if he had nothing to do with it, apparently he was asked later, like so many people, hey, do you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot? And he said, no.
No. He does not. He does not.
I don't understand. You're in the same city and you don't know. Like, I know where I was when John Lennon was killed. I mean, I can remember the foot of the stairs in my basement, you know, I remember everything about it. I don't know how I could forget if I was in New York that John Lennon.
Man.
It's unreal.
But that he was officially in Fort Worth, you know, because later in the afternoon after JFK was shot, there was a phone call made by apparently George Bush saying that I'm in Fort Worth and blah, 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 blah. But I mean, it was a very strange phone call. And very obviously, when you look into it, there to create an alibi for himself.
Yeah, but you'd still remember where you say, oh, well, yeah, I was in Fort Worth. I mean, I couldn't believe
it.
You'd remember. You'd be in the same state. You don't recall this? Wow. Okay. I don't believe that either.
There's also taking photos of him just outside the Texas School Book Depository. He claims that it's not him, but there's been people, you know, very, very good in facial structure, FBI, you know, people working for the FBI identifying facial structures that has identified him.
While people are running into the building or something?
No, this is after the shooting. But as far as I've been able to find out, he was in the Daltex building. You know, there was one team of shooters in the Daltex building. There was, if you want, I can go quickly through who was in Dealey Plaza as far as I've been able to find out.
Okay, we can. Here's the thing. We have, what am I going to say here? We don't have any problem with time over here. If you want to keep going, I don't want to take your time, but if you're willing to go long, we are willing to go long.
Okay, we can do that.
Okay, let's do it. So the list, please.
Okay, the list, please. And the winner is,
that's right, the loser. No, is, I guess,
as,
in this case,
as far as I've been able to find out, if we start at the Daltex building, that is right on the corner of Houston Street and Elm Street, where the school book depository is to the left next to Elm Street. From the second floor, under the fire stairs, there's one shooter. As far as I've been able to find out, his name was Chucky Nicoletti. He was the lieutenant of Sam Giancana from...
the mob boss.
The mob in...
Was he...
Chicago.
Right.
He was one of the lieutenants and one of the major hitmen for him. Very sophisticated, calm man, and very brutal as well. Chucky Nicoletti, he was the shooter. The spotter in that building, the guy with the binoculars and so on, was a man by the name of Nestor Izquierdo, Tony Nestor Izquierdo. There's a statue of him in Miami to this very day. He was a soldier, elite soldier, also very closely associated with Operation 40. In the same room, there was a mobster from L.A. Called Hale Braden, or Eugene Braden. He was the guy who opened the door on the backside of the Daltex building, letting these people in, together with George Bush Sr. And they used a mining office that was a CIA front company. And in that room was also Johnny Rosselli, who was a former hitman for Al Capone. And at this stage in life, he was very much like a liaison between Hollywood, the film stars, the Chicago mob, and the CIA. So he was the guy that sort of connected a lot of these things. Then if we go up into the Texas School Book Depository, this is... I cannot swear that this is the exact truth, but this is, as far as I've been able to to find out this is who was there. On the sixth floor where Oswald is said to have been, Oswald was actually a hero, I would say, a hero that was involved but was trying to stop the whole assassination and then took the fall for the whole thing and was killed for that. He had absolutely nothing to do with it. But anyway, on the sixth floor in the sniper's nest, the shooter up there was a man by the name of Eladio Del Valle, Operation 40. He was a former police officer from Cuba and a secret agent for the Batista regime there as well. But that was before Operation 40. He was the shooter there. Then the spotter was a black man. He was also part of Operation 40. His name was Herminio Diaz García. Okay, and then on the same floor, but in to the western part of the building, that the extreme left corner, the window there, the shooter there was a former Chicago police officer that was working for Sam Giancana once again, and his name was Richard Kane. Then if we go down on the street level, you have when the motorcade turn around the corner, on the left-hand side, there's a man. You can see it. It's just when Kennedy gets hit in the throat, when he gets his arm up. If you look at an uncut version of the Zapruder film, you will see, look above the motorcade, look above the limo. There's a man in khaki trousers, khaki shirt, with a big, big dark brown or black bulletproof vest. Very, very obvious once you see it. And you will see that he pulls off. It looks like he's almost doing a tactical stand with a small weapon. And as soon as the car moves on, he just, after firing something, or I'm not sure if he fired, but it sure looks like a weapon he's holding there, he just lets his hands go down by the sides. His name is Walter Tobinski. He's a citizen of Toronto. He, as far as I know, he's still alive.
Oh, and I should try to get him on the show. Good luck with that.
Walter Tobinski and his cousin, who are still alive as well, resident of Toronto, these two have been some of the major cleanup killers around many of the major assassinations. These are the ones that have been part of taking, you know, carrying out many of these suicides. And we're talking about 1,000 people each, as far as I've been able to find out.
So this Tobinski guy, he's in the, after Kennedy gets hit in the undamaged Zapruder film. And he's just above, like he's on the grass, just like above, near the lady with the red coat, or what is it?
No, long before that. You will see, if you see the where Kennedy brings up his hands to his throat, that it almost looks like he's the one firing the shot that makes Kennedy throw up his hands. So it's very early. It's just when they turn around the corner. And I believe that the man in the silvery suit behind him with a hat on, that is Orlando Bosch, Dr. Death, who was delivering the bomb to the Embassy Row bombing and so on.
Okay.
Anyway, Walter Tobinski is also the guy that in the movie JFK and many, many books, you will see that somebody saying that he was Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City at the Cuban consulate and the Russian consulate as well, trying to pretend that he was Lee Harvey Oswald. Then when he left the buildings, they took photos. The CIA took photos of this man. So there's photographs of this man. That is Walter Tobinski.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's get a spelling on this. I got Walter. That's okay. Tobinski, what's
Walter
that?
Walter Tobinski, Tabinski, as far as I know. Okay. Maybe with a Y, I'm not sure. Tobinski.
Well, okay, I just wanted to make sure because, you know, sometimes people want to look these things up. If we're telling them to wake up, I guess they better take a Google around and take some looks at these people.
And Clyde Forshaw, I mean, we're talking somebody who has killed about 1,000 people here. He's been working as a bus driver and a streetcar driver in Toronto for decades as a front.
Who is this?
His name is Clyde Forshaw. He's Walter Tobinski's cousin.
Okay. A streetcar driver. Wow. All right.
Yeah. There's an incredible witness called, her name is Haley Otis, and she's come forward with extreme evidence about these two people. She grew up together with them. Her brother was involved with them, both in the JFK assassination and also many of the other ones, the major ones. And she has recorded, or she's called Professor Jim Fetzer in the States. I don't know if you know him.
I don't know him personally, but I'd love to have him on. But yeah, sure.
He's one of the world's major experts in the JFK assassination, 9/11, Sandy Hook, and so on. A former Marine, and so on. And she has been over a period of 2 or 3 years calling him. He has recorded these phone calls, and about 6 months ago. So to protect her, because she was in a major risk of getting murdered, because they were aware of her giving this evidence to Fetzer, I and Fetzer decided to go live with these recorded phone calls, so that if anything happens to Haley Otis, it would point straight to Walter Tobinski and Clyde Forshaw. That is why I'm naming them here again. So if anything, if she even gets hurt in any way or form, it would be pointing right at these two guys, okay? And on my website, there's Light on Conspiracies. You can go in the menu, and there's one called Serial Killers. If you click on that one, you will see I've got about 60 hours of interviews with her, these recorded phone calls. Just if you start listening to them, please understand that she's covering many, many different areas. It can sound very confusing to start with, but once you start putting the pieces together, she has never, never lied about anything as far as I've been able to find out, especially about the historical cases.
Right.
These are the ones I find interesting, not her opinions on current events and so on. It's the old, like the JFK, the killing of John, which she claims
right.
Also.
Oh, sure. The shoot down of the airplane that was, it was supposed to be really foggy, they said, but then other people said, no, it was good weather.
No, it was not a shoot down. It was explosives in the back of
right.
The
right. I mean, a deliberate takedown of the plane, as opposed to he crashed in the fog.
Absolute not true. It was a total.
Why? Because I think people would vote for him as well. He'd say, you know, my dad was killed. My uncle was killed. There's some stuff going on here. He had that magazine out called George, which was quite popular. And he would have crushed George Bush were he allowed to run against him instead of Al Gore.
And Hillary Clinton.
Sure.
You know, you had to check out these people, because he was, had he run for president and he was talking about doing it, it would have been like a major, what do you call it? He would just go straight, boom, to the top.
Sure.
Everybody
oh, yeah.
Worked for him. He had it all. He had the charisma. He had the name. He had the background. He had the sympathy. He had the knowledge. He had the looks.
All
you
of
name it.
It. Yep.
All of it. Yeah. And in my opinion, that is why they took him out. And according to Haley Otis, it was Clyde Forshaw and his son and another guy who the day before placed the explosives in the plane.
Wow.
So sad.
Another obfuscated investigation. Very interesting to me that it seems so obvious at the time motivationally. And then it turns out, as you're saying, a lot of this evidence points towards it. But the remainder of the Kennedy family has never really been, you know, super vocal about solving any of these things, and of course, most recently, the John takeout.
But can you blame them? I mean,
they're probably scared.
Wouldn't you be?
Sure. And then you have Ted Kennedy, who did live for a long, long time, but never really seemed to be the legitimate kind of JFK, RFK threat. And then also, he was compromised and never could. Yeah, Chappaquiddick. No one was ever going to vote for someone that did that. It's amazing he stayed in where he did, but, you know, they kind of politically assassinated him.
And this is, do you know, like with assassinations like JFK or Olof Palme or people like that, do you know, it would be so easy to just drop a pill in their coffee, you know?
Well, that's what I mean. Why? Yeah.
They do it to statue an example. They show, with the JFK, for instance, they showed there that day that we can take out anyone at any time, anywhere. So whoever you are, just back off and stay in line. That is one. And this is also when there are conspiracies on that level carried out. It's almost like there's a secondary conspiracy following, and that conspiracy is of silence. There's this absolute silence from the official point of view. It's the patsy, it's the patsy, it's the patsy. Nothing about anything else.
Right.
And that is because people, it's not that they know the details about the murder, but they know the power behind it, you know? And they know if I start messing around, I'll be next.
So how have you managed to escape this type of retribution given the span of your research and its ease of availability? I mean, you're putting it out there all the time.
Yeah, but to start with, I found out, you know, on a very early stage, you know, the more I started studying these things, I saw, oh my God, there's so many normal people that have died, you know, journalists, witnesses, all of the normal people are not aware of how many people have been taken out. You know, I have a list around the JFK assassination, about 300 people. I know other people, researchers say 70. I have over 300, you know, where very suspicious death. And there was one person working with statistics, and he said the chances of dying young or too early, if you had any part or any knowledge or any kind of involvement in the JFK assassination, was 3 trillion times higher than for normal people.
Wow.
So we're talking, you're in a minefield when you start digging around in these things. And I found very early on that there's two ways to go about this. Either you get the spotlight on you big time for some kind of protection, because if you are taken out with the spotlight on you, then that will just confirm what you've been saying and what you've been proving, and that can make a major mess for these people. Or you go stealth, under the radar, be discreet, do not show, you know. And this is what I chose to do for years. I've tracked down here in Sweden, I tracked down foreign agents, mercenaries, assassins. I met many of the witnesses. I met many of the police officers involved and so on. And many of them have no idea that they met me, because I've been discreetly out to the left or to the right when they were talking to other people. Do you see? But then it came to a point where two of my friends, we were a small group of investigators, just normal private people who were very, very saddened about what had happened in Sweden and just totally shocked that it could actually happen. Because I thought I lived in a country where there was no corruption, no violence, no nothing like that, that you could trust the police and so on. And then suddenly, boom, I got into this very, very dark world of all of these things right in front of me.
Well, you said this before about John F. Kennedy being the last real officially elected decent president. And ever since then, it's been an apparatus of doom, pretty much. Is that the same case in Sweden ever since the death of Palme?
Well, every single one that has been in power since has been either a member of the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderberg Group. But Palme was also a member of the Bilderberg Group. This is not a clear, clean-cut case, you know, the assassination of Olof Palme. I did about 9-hour interview on Red Eyes Creations, where we took it down in 2-hour segments, piece by piece, because it's so multi-layered. There are different operations going on at the same time where they're not aware of each other, and it's just very, very complicated. So if anybody's interested, I've got it on my membership area, or if you go to Red Eyes Creations and listen there. Very, very complex case. But like I said, I had two friends who did not have a good feeling that for were not sensitive to the fact that we were walking around in a minefield. Because the thing is, with this type of information, you are in a minefield, but you don't know when you stepped over the line before it's too late. You know, you have no idea, and then boom, suddenly you're hit by a car, or you get a visit in the night, or like one guy, his name was Ingvar Hamer. He was found in the subway with his head crushed. He survived, but then when he started getting better, they moved him to a different hospital that were less equipped and but not as good in any way. And then he died by complications. His autopsy protocol was not released until after 8 months, and we kept pressing to get it out there. And then the protocol, when you read it, the whole way of writing it is not that it's an accident, which was claimed officially, but it was that it was forced, violence forced to the skull, the exact way they write in Swedish when somebody's hit in the head with something very hard.
Mm.
And the other one, he was absolutely fine. He went in for a health check, came out, and had an aggressive cancer that just knocked him out within a few weeks. Got to the center of his vocal center, and he just died there quickly afterwards.
Wow. That's.
But also here in Sweden, I've got a whole chapter in the book called, it's just Mystery Deaths, you know?
Mystery Deaths.
Yeah.
Sure, and, that's a huge
and
topic.
I would also claim that, I don't know if you've heard about that in Toronto or in Canada, but in 1994, there was a major ferry disaster on the east coast of Sweden between Estonia and Sweden.
Not only had I heard of it, I was in a similar, almost disaster, in the same kind of craft that this particular ship had. The bow doors apparently didn't seal properly. And after that particular event, all of that same model of ferry had its bow doors sealed shut. And but of course, it wasn't just the waves crashing into it that caused the problem. I'm sure you're about to tell us.
No, she was blown up. She was blown up. There was explosives. There's even photos of the explosives by divers sent down.
And who was in this, and why did this happen?
Oh, we're getting us in. I could do a whole show just about that.
Okay, well, maybe we'll do that later. But I mean,
it's a major thing. But there was almost 1,000 people killed there, innocent people, yeah. You know, and once again carried out with very cold blood. You know, taking care of business. And boom, unreal. And with these connections directly to 9/11 as well. Yeah. So this is the whole thing. The deeper you dig into these major ones globally, there's this tendency of finding back to the same people, connecting back to the same people.
Hmm.
Do you know, for instance, you had, there were 9 members of the crew in this Estonia, this MS Estonia that went down. They were first rescued. The second captain was filmed. They were filmed, and they were put on the list of survivors. The families were phoned up and said, yeah, they're fine. They're being taken to this hospital, then that hospital. They'll be home in a day or two. And then suddenly they end up on the list of dead.
Right.
Okay? They're dead. The bodies are not there. They disappeared. Okay, and then after years of research, we find out that there were 2 planes, 2 private jets that came to Sweden that evening, where they took these 9 crew members on board. The flight fee at the airport, the Bromma airport here in Stockholm, were paid by the American embassy, and then they were flown out to just disappear. Nobody really knows where they went. But one of these planes were owned by a Swedish billionaire. I think his name is Sven Magnusson. And the other one is owned by an American company called AEG, where Hank Greenberg was one of the owners. He was a former, I think he was a former director of the Federal Reserve Bank. He was very closely associated with Henry Kissinger. Many top positions, and the office in the 9/11 where the first plane hit, that was spot on their office, you know.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then you see how the whole cover up, how the whole thing is carried out, where these people pop up again and again and again and again and again. Coincidences?
Your friend who came up with the trillions odds. There's so many of these things where, I mean, I've wanted to sit down and go, what do you think the odds are? Of course, I could never work this out, but you do get to know that it's just over and over again staggeringly incredible. Like in certain situations, such as that you've been describing for us, even in one situation that those odds would take place, but to find the same thing kind of repeated MO-wise on all of these different things, that's got to increase those odds exponentially against being all of those things being able to happen with all of these tie-ins and people involved in so many of these crimes. I mean, how do people – I think people just don't want to know. That's what I think. That's how they get away with it. Not that they're necessarily asleep. I guess sometimes they are, but just don't want to know. Can't imagine this is a thing that they've got to deal with intellectually, politically, in any way, shape, or form. Just rather be told, but here's the agenda, we're going to war, okay, there's always war, there's always taxes, and just kind of believe all this. Because mathematically, how could you? It's just amazing.
But Alan, it's taken me 30 years to find out these things. You know, I had no idea. I was buying into the official story myself to start with. It's only after 30 years, I'm delivering facts here, after 30 years that where you can see it very obvious. This has been hidden by design, multi-layered. They've done everything to cover this up, you know. So, but this is what where I feel it's such a good time to be alive, because this is where it's all coming up in the open.
Yeah. Well, it is exciting, but it's also kind of frightening and frustrating that these, you know, wars keep going on and, you know, people will break a ceasefire and continue with arms sales while they apparently are trying to broker peace deals. I mean, the dichotomy of that is simply ridiculous, and that's on the mainstream news being presented to people. So
it's time to wake up. It really is. And we have a major responsibility, I think, because every single day that we are asleep and that we are letting these people get away with what they're doing, innocent people are getting killed and tortured and are sitting in prison rotting away. You know, this is not okay. It is not a time to change the channel and get another slice of pizza. This is the time to say, whoa, wait a second. What we need to wake up here, you know?
Yeah, I fantasized years ago. What would the world be like if that kind of thing weren't taking place? If Kennedy saying, no, I'm not going into Cuba and killing a bunch of people and making it look like it was something else under this Operation Northwoods, and decided to govern the way he wanted to, with getting the Federal Reserve out of the picture and the invasive, particularly, which is probably most of it, invasive aspects of the CIA, get that to shut down, break it into 1,000 pieces. Where would we have been with minds like this, you know, allowed to create a better future for ourselves? And time and again, every time somebody pops up with this, boom, down he goes. It's getting a bit exhausting.
It is. It is. And I tell you, I'm on my knees. I am so exhausted as well, because it's been such a long road to walk, you know, such a scary road. I've lost people that I really cared for. I had to leave my country because I had a visit. They really scared me a lot. And I'm living in a country where I'm not born. I love it, but then again, that's not the point. The point is that it is enough. I'm tired. So many people are tired. All these unjust wars. I often in these, like I said, I kept a very low profile until 2012. Then I let my book out for free on the internet in one go. I had, I think, over more than 40,000 downloads before I started charging for it. I'm on my knee financially. I'm just trying to feed my family. They targeted me. My website is knocked out of space all the time. I'm having technical problems. I don't have an income. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it is enough. It is enough. We have had enough. And many... since 2012, I've been on, I don't know, hundreds of interviews. I do everything I can to get out there, to show people what's going on, to wake people up in uniform, you know, soldiers, police officers, SWAT teams, people that are working in FEMA camps or are a plumber or delivering toilets to FEMA camps or you know, equipping these railway station, you know, the train wagons. And you have to wake up to what is going on, because this small group, once again, they're very, very small, this group, are really trying to take over this world. I would say, strongly suggest, when you hear the world, the New World Order, change it to the Fourth Reich. It is following the exact same template as Hitler was trying to pull off, with the same finances, the same financial structure behind him. They're still in place. They've just changed the names. It looks a lot more pretty, and it's high-tech nowadays. They're trying to pull the same one off, but this time, if they do it, the future does not look very nice for any one of us.
No. Yeah. Ulla is a researcher, many years into this study of conspiracies, 30 years in. It's not exactly like he's profiting from it. He's trying to put it out there so people can understand what we need to do. You brought up an interesting point earlier, and I'd like to put it on the that hat on the bad guys for a second. You said there's a couple of different ways you can go. You can be a behind-the-scenes researcher, or you can be right out there, sort of putting it out there and making sure that you're kind of a well-known target, so if something does go wrong, everybody will realize. So there are two different ways to go about it. There's also two different ways, those same two ways, to go about this manipulation. For example, the Bush people that we do know, the president, one time vice president and then president, who probably was the president the whole time, his son, we hear about these Bushes, Barbara Bush, you know, we hear about them. But there are a couple of other Bushes that we don't really hear about. Do you know who I'm speaking of?
There's a whole line waiting.
Yeah, but there's Neil, and he was involved in the finances of the savings and loan scandal in the 80s. He was involved. And then apparently he was also monetarily involved in a different Bush. Marvin Bush involved in the security companies.
9/11.
Of the 9/11. These and guys Jeb. Never get talked about. Why don't they get spoken of? It's always Jeb and George and those people, and then these other guys doing just as much or more so politically behind the scenes, never get to hear about them at all. What are they doing?
Go figure. You go find out. I mean, I would very much like these people to be exposed, because I would be very surprised if they're not up to the same type of thing as well.
Yeah, like the involvement with the security companies, all of which involved in 9/11, whether it was building security of the WTC itself or Logan Airport, you know? I mean, these are all interconnected at that level.
Yeah. Alan, I'm getting tired.
Oh, I'll bet you.
No, well, it's – I just want to say, if anybody wants to support me, because I would very much like that this could be an exchange of energy. I put 30 years into it, not for my own benefit, to create a better future for us all.
Well, let's do that. Let's make everybody understand how they can help you out. And you know, you're leading such a great charge with this research. Where absolutely can we find you to help?
It's sign up for my newsletter, sign up as a member, the donations button, these type of thing. Financially, that's the point where I'm weak at the moment, and they're very aware of it. Every time I get hit right, left, and center, my PayPal account gets messed around with, and so on. I really, really appreciate that type of support, because I don't know how to be able to continue. I'm in a point now where I'm confused. I do not know what the next step is going to be. I so much want to continue. I'm willing to take the risk. I'm willing to stand in the line of fire right up there. If you need me, if I can do any type of difference for the better, count me in. I was right outside the Bilderberg meeting, speaking right in front of the Bilderberg members, with police surveillance, with helicopters, everything. I'll do it. I'm happy to do it. But I need also support from you to join the whole thing so that we can lift it. We're so close to pulling this off, to stop this whole madness. There's a beautiful, beautiful video. You can find it on my the front page on my website, lightandconspiracies.com. If you scroll down, it says how a natural movement is started. Look at that one and see that the, I would say the tipping point has already been passed. There's such an emotion going globally, such an awakening going on. And that is why this global elite are getting very, very sloppy, I would say, because all these so-called mass shootings lately and so on, it's so sloppy, so badly done, no preparation, no budgets. You know, it's like they're trying to get us to go and watch Rocky 19, you know, like they pulled all the other ones. They can't come up with new ideas, so you just keep repeating the old thing again and again in new variations. But people don't buy it anymore. And there's another video on YouTube called The Tiny Dot that is also very, very symbolic of what is going on, how tiny, tiny, tiny this group of people are, and how incredible, ridiculous it is that we are letting them rule, that we're letting them control our lives. You know, yeah. We should just say, listen, you go fight your own wars. We'll go and have a beer and have a nice time together, you know.
Yeah, let's send them out onto the front. Absolutely. Yeah.
They can go and do whatever crazy stuff they want with themselves. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing Henry Kissinger go out there, get some boxing gloves on and show some courage for once, you know. But we'll never see them do it.
Well, he can't even fly to some places because they know that he'll be arrested.
And this is due to, I must say, people like myself who have dedicated such a great part of their life trying to reveal what is going on.
Well, thanks for doing that, Ulla. You have been very generous with your time, and you bit off a lot when you started this 30 years ago, and now you're stuck sort of helping the rest of us speed up and fast forward through all of the research that you've done and doing this show and other shows that I've heard you on. I first came across you on Red Ice Creations, also coming out of Sweden. And so thanks for doing what you do. Folks, get on this website, Light on Conspiracies. Have a look, see what's there, and try to dispel it. Try to put some kind of mathematical spin on it where it really kind of does make sense. You're not going to be able to do it. That's my challenge to you. Ulla Dommegård, thanks for coming on. Will you come on again sometime? I promise I won't keep you for 5 hours that time.
I'll tell you, anytime, Alan. Anytime. You want me on 3 hours again, no problem. I just need a breathing space and whatever. You know, if I can make a difference, I'm right there.
Well, thank you very much. Have a fantastic rest of your day, and I really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.